Pool days call for cookouts and lots of laundry. This Memorial Day at Lowe's, save $80 on a Charbroil Performance Series 4-Burner Gas Grill. Now just $199. Plus, get up to 45% off select major appliances to keep dishes, clothes, and food fresh. Having fun in the sun is easy with us in your corner. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 5/27. While supplies last, selection varies by location. See associate or Lowe's.com for details.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday Follow-Up for Season 18, Episode 19. This week, we heard Bob's conversation with Emilio Corsetti about his docuseries, Framed, The Kit Martin Story. This was a great conversation and a true justice warrior work from Emilio. We are sans Janet today, and I am recovering from a cold, but Bob and I are here to discuss all your listener theories. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
Yeah, first of all, it should be pointed out that Janet's on assignment. You have a cold. I've had such a disaster of a, so our pre-gamers, I had an issue going on right when the show started. So we've been juggling all day. So hopefully we got our heads on straight here. As far as housekeeping goes, no, just as I've been letting you guys know with my students, Underestimated, the series, the team that I was talking about a while back that had a really unique take for our stream, because everything's been true crime up till now. The team that's talking about how partisan politics is affecting them as students and up-and-coming voters, that series has been launched. So last Friday, part one came out. Theirs is called Crashing the Parties, is what their team called their section of the podcast. On Wednesday, which for us now would be tomorrow, for when you guys are listening to this, a couple days ago, on Wednesday, their episode two came out. And on Friday, the day this is airing, their episode three is coming out. So, yeah, I would highly encourage you guys to go listen to that. It's really interesting to hear the perspective of some young people who are, you know, looking at what's going on with the world around them and how they see it and how they've kind of researched it and how it's kind of making them feel. It's a really interesting take. So you guys should definitely check that out. Devin in the chat says, first episode was beautiful. Thank you. They were asking me, Colton, one of the students that's in that group, was just asking me, has anybody made any comments yet? And I was like, no, not yet. So that's probably a good one, because it's politics, so it's going to be touchy. Ooh, I told you, yeah. You got to be careful. So the first comment is from Devin that I've seen that says the episode was beautiful. So I'll pass that along to the group. Yeah, other than that, no real housekeeping. Don't have a lot of questions from this week. So I thought I would give you guys a little bit of I'm going to talk for a few minutes about this really unique experience I've had over the last couple of days. I was able to host and have a little barbecue and spend some quality family time with my good friend Jim Clementi here at my house this weekend. It was really cool. My patrons, you guys know, because a lot of you guys joined the live stream when we did our recording yesterday. But yeah, Jim is traveling the country. He's got this little kind of RV thing. He was visiting a bunch of people around the country and he was coming by here. So we stopped by here Sunday and it was just really nice. You know, Jim and I have been friends. We didn't really realize it. Did you see the picture I put up, Zach, where we took a picture in our studio?
I did, with the picture in the background.
Yeah. So Jim came out. He wanted to see the office and the studio, and I kind of showed him everything, and he just saw his picture on the wall. He's like, oh man, that's awesome. I'm like, yeah. And I hadn't thought about it till that moment. We took that picture over 10 years ago.
That's incredible.
A decade ago. We took that picture. So we took a new picture, a selfie with that selfie in the background of it. So you can see, you know, 10-year span of us.
I love it. A little inception.
Yeah. And so what was cool was we had, so for my program at the high school, we have an advisory committee that meets twice a year to do exactly what it sounds like, advise us on what we should do with the program. So we get people from industry to be involved in that. Janet's on the advisory board. Patrick Hines is on it. Bob Mata is on it. Josh Hallmark's on it. You know, I've got a lot of people from all over the industry that are part of that. And Jim's on it. And so he had called me Saturday. He's like, I'm going to be coming through about 4 o'clock Sunday. And I was like, man, that's great. You can just come crash here. Unfortunately, I can't take Monday off work because I have this meeting that I have to do. And you're supposed to be, and I got to be at it. And he's like, yeah, I thought I'd go to it in person. So I told him he didn't need to go sit there with my students all day long. So he hung out here. I went to work. About noon he came. So my last couple hours before the meeting. And I know like Colton, who I was just talking about, is just really obsessed with Jim. He loves Criminal Minds. He loves the idea of profiling. He met him on Zoom last year and like freaked out and couldn't talk.
Oh,
so he was all
awesome.
Excited that Jim was going to be there. But other than that, you know, these young kids, I don't know, you know, young adults, you know, who they're interested in. So Jim comes walking in. Colton gets out of his other class. They let him out so he can come meet Jim and come hang out with Jim for a little bit. And then one of my students, Brendan, comes walking in the classroom for 6 hours. He walks in and Jim's standing there. He walks by him and goes, "What? I think I just saw you on TikTok." like what? And I thought he meant like he saw my social media post or something. He's like, "No, yeah. Look." And he showed this TikTok where Jim was talking about the Nancy Guthrie case.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Like, I literally just was watching. This is you, right? And he's like, yeah, that's me. He's like, holy. So they're talking. And then a former student of mine from last year who you guys heard, and actually she, I think her voice was in the first couple episodes of the Brandy Peltz case. If you listen to Underestimated, Elena, she's in a different class this semester. She popped in just to say hi to me and saw Jim. And so she's going to college to go be a forensic psychologist. And she's
incredible.
Like, oh my God, I'm freaking out. And it's adorable because Jim is 10 feet away from her and she keeps very loudly whispering to me, Mr. Ruff, do you think he'll take a picture with me? I'm like, why don't you ask him? He can hear you, you know? So then I had our friends from Second Main were bringing refreshments for the meeting. So I step out for a couple minutes. And if anybody saw on my social media, I put a picture up of this. I leave the room. There's four kids in the room. And they're just kind of standing around and a couple of them are talking to Jim. I step out real quick to help Alicia in to get the food in from Second and Main. Come back in the room and here's Jim standing there holding court. And there's like eight students. I don't even know where they came from. They're not even in my class that hour that are in like a semicircle around him just hanging on every word. One of them asked him something about the Nancy Guthrie case and he started explaining it and they're just fascinated. I'm like, son of a, these kids don't listen to me like that.
That's
like,
hilarious. What the hell?
It was, I mean, they were locked in. I had to peel them away when it was time to do the meeting. So yeah, it was really cool. And then Jim came back. So I'll give you guys a little teaser now before we get into this. So Jim and I decided, we're like, well, you're here. I'm here. I was there when he recorded the first ever episode of Real Crime Profile in his studio. And he's like, well, we got to record something in your studio before I go. So we rushed back from school because he had to leave because he had to go get on to his next stop. And his little RV is electric. So he's like, I got to get this far, this amount of time, I got to go. But we came in and you'll hear this episode is going to air on Sunday. Some of the patrons were already participating in the live chat during it. But you'll hear when we start, we literally decided at school, let's do a podcast. We got here, like, what are we going to talk about? Like, we'll figure it out. We sit down to record and he's like, hey, let's see if we can get Kathy, who is his co-host on Real Crime Profile. Let's see if we can get Kathy to come on too. So for our patrons this won't be part of the audio, but for the patron video, they got, you know, 30 minutes of me and Jim just yapping while we're trying to get Kathy lined up to get on. So then Kathy finally gets on. And so we get on with no plan. Let's just talk for a little bit. And we start talking. I mention his conversation about the Nancy Guthrie case. Jim and Kathy really break down that case for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. in the course of that conversation, I mentioned something about Delphi.
And I think I said this.
Well, so I forgot. I completely forgot. Remember when we were covering Delphi, their kind of take on it, or Jim's take on it, was Richard Allen's guilty.
Yeah.
I totally forgot about that. So in the course of the conversation, I said, you know, and, you know, this reminds me of Delphi. And you have Richard Allen, who, you know, may or may not be guilty. And they're both like, ah, they got the right guy. And I'm like, huh, okay. Now that you're here, let's have a conversation about this.
Oh,
let's,
you know, boy.
And so, dude, it was, I've never been more, I've just had some just interviews lately that I've just really loved. The one with Dwayne Betts is like top of my list. And this conversation with Jim and Kathy about Delphi, it started, you know, it's like here live on the air, Jim and I are going to disagree about a case and we're going to be fighting. So we start talking and we, you know, I start filling him in on some facts and we start kind of debating and discussing things back and not debating, but discussing things back and forth. And if you listen to it, it is one of the coolest things. So everybody, the haters of anyone in podcast land, always wants to box us into a corner, right? So my thing is, you know, everybody's, oh, you're biased and you think everybody's innocent, right? That's my thing, right? And with Jim, you always hear, well, he's a blowhard and he just never, you know, once he's setting his opinion, he's just going to, you hear this stuff about, you know, people say about us. What was awesome about that conversation was Jim went into the conversation with a very strong opinion. He and Kathy were very, very open to hearing, because they were basing their opinion based on what they had read online and what had been reported in the media and what had been, they'd heard from, you know, they'd been to like seminars where some of the investigators spoke about the case. So they felt like they had the most critical info, you know, everything they needed. As they're listening, you hear the open-mindedness of what a good investigator should do. Right. So it's not like at the end of the conversation, they're like, oh, you're right. He's innocent. Mm-hmm. But as they're hearing the conversation, as they're hearing and they're getting no new information, they're open to changing their opinion. That turned into just a really, really good conversation where, you know, now Jim's talking about some profiling things, you know, and now that he has more information about the case. So anyway, make sure you tune in on Sunday, because I thought it was a fascinating conversation. And I know a lot of you guys are really into the Delphi case. So there's, I think the last 40 minutes of the episode is all Delphi talk.
Oh, I'm excited. I'm super excited for that.
This heat is doing the most, and your patience isn't. It's time to find something that actually cools you off. Head to 7-Eleven and grab a delicious chicken sandwich with 7 rewards at 7-Eleven. Crispy, craveable, and way better than settling for the same old, same old. It's available at 7-Eleven and just $4 with 7 rewards. Visit your local Columbus 7-Eleven and satisfy that craving today. Valid through 6/23/26. Toppings sold separately while supplies last. Participating stores, see app for full terms.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So with that being said, we should talk about this case. So this one, Emilio, was great. I love having, especially, you know, a newer independent creator. You know, he's an author, but his work in this space is new. I think that the work he did was great. The case is fascinating.
It really
again,
is.
I'm still trying, like I'm fascinated by it. Why I'm just trying to get more and more info about it, because it really is intriguing. I just finished it. You know, when I recorded the episode, I hadn't finished the whole series. I have since finished the entire series. Zach's listened to the entire series. We didn't get a lot of questions about it, but there's a few things that I know we want to talk about. One is there was a lot of talk about firearms and bullets, and there was a particular type of bullet I wasn't super familiar with. But I know you are, Zach. So I guess I'll start with your thoughts on the the case, the series in general, and then, yeah, anything that you find really intriguing that you'd like to talk about.
So I thought that Emilio did a phenomenal job putting this together. Obviously, it's very, very, very well researched. Like you said in the episode, go watch the YouTube series. The YouTube series is what you need. I watched it like that. You could get it through the audio. The YouTube series with the video component is what you need to see, because there's so many fascinating things. The case truly is strange as hell. Like, because on its surface, it looks straightforward. It looks like Kit committed these murders. There's so many things, you know, that Kit committed these murders. And then the deeper you dive, the weirder it gets. And obviously, you know me, you know I'm a big firearms guy. So I was very interested when they started talking about the ballistics and all of the weirdness that revolves around that. We can dive into it. I'm sure that I'll come up with more, but those rounds that they talked about in that, they're very specific rounds, the G2 research RIP rounds. They are a very specific home defense round. So most of the time when you get a home defense round, they're considered like jacketed hollow points, or they're called hollow points. And what it is the projectile, the little part that comes out of the bullet that shoots down the barrel, has a indentation in the end so that when it makes impact, it spreads more. Two reasons. One, it causes more damage. Two, it stops over-penetration. Now, anybody that's in the defense world of firearms knows that over-penetration is a real danger. So what I mean by over-penetration is if there's an incident and I have to pull my firearm to shoot an assailant or whoever it may be, if there's a guy robbing me and I pull my firearm to shoot an assailant, if once that bullet leaves my firearm, I am responsible for it, no matter where it goes. So the reason I say over-penetration is it could go through that assailant, through a wall, and hit a child in a house next to you.
Right.
And you are responsible for that bullet. Wherever it is discharged, you're responsible for it. So that's why they started making
I think
these.
That on that note, I think that, and I don't know if it's because of TV, but I feel like a lot of people don't realize that in most cases, unless you have one of these types of bullet, a hollow point bullet, in most cases, a bullet will pass through unless it's from like a 22 or something, it does pass through. And that's probably not the time or place to get into it here, but that's one of the things that is baffling me with the whole Charlie Kirk assassination thing. Is, you know, he shot with a 30-06 in the neck and the bullet never comes out the back, and I still can't wrap my brain.
And that is a powerful round.
A very powerful, heavy round. It's a deer hunting round, so it's one I'm familiar with. I've shot deer with that round, and, you know, the chest where you shoot a deer through ribs, through heart, lungs, ribs on the other side, and still continues on past it. So the idea of it hitting, you know, a neck and not coming out the back, but just that little bit has really not much to do with this, other than the fact that, it is a thing. If you shoot somebody with a full metal jacket round out of a 40 caliber pistol, it's probably coming out the back.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a through and through shot. So they started making these self-defense rounds called hollow points, which is the point of them is so they spread. They spread on impact. They create a larger wound, which is not necessarily the point. It's to stop over-penetration. Now, here in point comes the weirdness of these RIP rounds. These RIP rounds look like a hollow point, and I don't know the word he kept using, but essentially, they almost look like a little serrated knife. And each one of those little prongs on that hollow point breaks off, and it is purposely made to cause damage. Now, in a text to you, I wrote that I'm very aware of these rounds, and I've never purchased them. And I know that I'm not the only one, and this is just a weird anecdotal thing. There's not a lot of people in the firearms industry that are very accepting of these rounds. These rounds are to cause damage, and that is solely the purpose of those rounds, which I for one, and I know there's a lot of other defensive shooters and a lot of other people out there that are not about that, right? Right? It's not about causing damage. It's about neutralizing what you need to do. Like, I don't need to blow a hole in a guy like you'd see in a movie.
Right.
It's ridiculous. These rounds are made to kill somebody. And that is the only reason they're out there. And it's kind of disgusting. So that leads me to my thought, which is sheerly an assumption. I don't think that Kit would have these rounds, being that he's a firearms person. I mean, they never found
That's
any.
Interesting, because I didn't realize that it was kind of taboo for people that are in that world.
It kind of is. And I know this is my circle. Maybe this is not all circles, but I've talked to multiple shooters in my circle and friends of mine that none of us have been interested in them because of that. If I'm carrying my firearm, which I do carry a firearm, it is solely for defense. I'm not out there trying to purposely harm anybody. It is to save my own life, right? I can do that with any round that I have in that gun. I do not need a round that is going to cause extreme damage, even to the point that it may not, I mean, it's going to really, really harm a person. A trigger warning, we're going to put this out there. In the docuseries, they show some of the exit wounds. And the exit wounds are very strange because the entrance wound looks like a normal firearms entrance room. You know, it's just a circular opening. But the exit are all these little spots, right? It's not what we typically see from an exit wound. And that's because those are literally like, they are supposed to shear off and cause damage. So that's
one projectile splits into multiple smaller projectiles.
Right. So again, obviously I don't know where this gentleman would stand on it, but being that he is very familiar with firearms, has a lot of firearms, seems to understand firearms, just doesn't seem like something he would have. Again, very anecdotal to me, but it's a thought I had.
Are they similar to, because what was, I don't know what those rounds are, but what they were, what it reminded me of were the Black Talon rounds. Is it similar to that or different even from that?
I don't know what a Black Talon, let me look it up really quick.
So Black Talons were one, and people use it, they were like supposed to be armor piercing, you know, so probably not actually now that I'm thinking about it, because I think they were a hollow tip that they were designed to shred, you know, they would even make them in hunting rounds as Black Talons. Okay.
So these are even more drastic than those.
Okay.
These literally have about 7 points on them that are only mildly connected. The brass is only mildly connected with the purpose of them shearing off. Not only do they shear off, the pieces that shear off break into pieces. Like, okay, for lack of a better word, you ever seen a Hershey bar and how when you open it, it has the pieces you can break off?
Yeah. So it's kind of scored like that.
The projectile is scored like that. So once it penetrates, it not only opens, it breaks apart. So again, this is a weird tangent to go on. I'm not a fan of those rounds. I don't know anybody in the world of firearms that really is interested in them. That is a destructive round that someone's doing something with.
Did you track, and I had a hard time, now I was at the gym and I was listening, not watching this part. But in the fifth episode, he's talking a lot about entrance and exit wounds. And there was a term he was using for, I can't remember the name, the term he was using, that you see this in the entrance wound and it's in the exit wound here. And he was kind of, did you track any of that or did any of that stick out to you?
Vaguely, he's talking about those little projectiles is what he's talking about. You know, and at one point he talks about that there was entrance wounds that were just those. So that he had the theory that it had hit something, which obviously it had to have hit something. His theory was that it was a window or the mirror of a car. I don't know that I believe that, but.
Well, that kind of leads to part of the, and this is not at all to disparage Emilio, but just us doing our job or me doing my job as an investigator. One thing that I would caution anybody listening to it is, and you heard some of it when he was on with me, where he says, the dog tag, which is something I do want to talk about more, is the dog tags, right? Where he says the dog tags were purchased as a novelty item and given to a teenager.
Yeah.
And I kind of called him out on it. I'm like, you just stated that as a fact when that is not a fact. It's a theory. It's a hypothesis, but it's not a fact. And I feel like he's, what I heard when I listened to it, and again, like I think he did a fantastic job of researching it. But when he comes to his conclusions, I just would caution people that, you know, he is not an investigator. He's a writer, and obviously he was a pilot, and you know, he's a very intelligent guy. But I could hear like he was making inferences and drawing conclusions in a way that as an investigator, I wouldn't. I wouldn't, you know, try to come to a conclusion when a conclusion can't possibly be drawn from it.
No, I kind of caught that as well. And like you said, I think he did a phenomenal job with the series. But he was stating a lot of things as fact that were opinion. And maybe not a lot is a stretch, but He was stating certain things as fact that were his opinion. Yeah. You know, we all know that you really can't do that. You know, there's a few things, again, the dog tags, the firearm, he has the theory that Calvin was shot and then put down the stairs and shot again. And he kind of stated that pretty bluntly. You know, that very well could be the case, but we don't know. You know,
yeah. So one thing what I found most intriguing about this, and I did say this in the episode, but I think it's worth bringing up again, is there is a lot of circumstantial evidence that points to Kit in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found myself when I was listening and watching thinking like this is a case where, you know, you guys heard me talk about with like Bart, you know, I'm the everybody's innocent guy. No, I'm not. Like, you guys heard me talk about it with Bob Mata when he was talking about the Barton McNeil case. You know, like, my opinion on that case, not that my mind can't be changed, but my opinion on that case is that, you know, I think that he was probably guilty. I have a lot of people that always throw the Darlie Rudier case at me. Some people that in our audience and that are just very invested in that case. I've looked at it a number of times, and I'm just not convinced that she's innocent. I'm not saying she is guilty. I'm not saying Barton McNeil is guilty, but it was like I don't see enough there without making leaps to say that I think this person is innocent. So, and I was kind of on that track with Kit Martin's case. But weirdly, and I've never had this happen, and I said this in the episode, I say it again, you know, I'm always the first one when everybody's got some broad conspiracy theory, you know, about a case to be like, nah, it's usually not, you know, no,
yeah,
he wasn't framed. It wasn't a mob hit. This is much more simple than that. But this is the weird case where it was like, if I'm just looking at the evidence against Kit, it's like, man, that's a hell of a lot of coincidences. But then when I looked at certain elements of it, the shell casing found on the porch and and specifically the dog tag. The dog tag is a big one for me. It was like, I see what looks like, from what I know about the case, and I haven't seen source material other than what Emilio shared, but it looks to me like this is obvious evidence of him being framed. And the dog tags, a couple things with the dog tags. There's two different elements of that. One is that is absolutely not a dog, not a military issue dog tag. Someone had that made, and there was the juror that came on that had all these different things and reasons for it. Like, I didn't buy any of that stuff. So I think most of you guys know this. I was never, you know, I'm not a veteran. I was never active duty in the military, but I was, you know, I went to college on an ROTC scholarship. I was a cadet in the Air Force. I have dog tags, and they're very specific. And I still carry around my late uncle's dog tags. You know, and it's, if you look at them, and I meant to grab them and bring them out here today, but I just got caught up with the other stuff I was doing. They're the same. Like, the format is the same. The name, the social security number. Now I'm trying to remember because it's been so long. It's been 20 years since I've looked at them, 10 years since I've looked at them. But I think it even has like your religious affiliate. It says like Protestant on it. It's got your blood type. Like, it's very, they're exactly the same. Those are not real dog tags. So that's one thing. It's interesting. Like, why would he have it? And then the whole idea of the reasons why they would put him on a string. Like, I don't know. I don't.
It was wild.
Again,
it was really wild. And we actually do have a question about this. I'll read this question really quick and we can kind of discuss it since we're onto the dog tags. Questions from Jessica. Actually, all our questions are from Jessica. I'll just throw that out there right now. Jessica is the hero this week. But question about the dog tags from Jessica. It is said that military issued dog tags would have a blood type, and the ones found did not. However, the image clearly shows O positive on the dog tags. Lots of other things don't make sense about these tags. I'm not saying it's real, just pointing out. Also, the prosecutor says he never said it was his dog tag, but I thought Kit said early in his testimony that it wasn't his tag.
If I remember correctly, in his testimony, they never asked him that question.
Yeah.
You know, I think they were asking him if this was, you know, an official one, and he was saying that it looks like a novelty tag or whatever, but I don't remember them asking specifically, is it yours? Yeah. And I didn't, that was one of the points where I was like listening and not watching. So I don't know from the picture if it had, I was just, from what I heard, he said it didn't have his blood type on it. Did you see it, Zach? Do you know?
You know, I did not. I was tattooing while I was listening and watching. So you know how well do that. So I did not see every image. I don't know that I saw it or not. I could go back and look at it.
The big giveaway is that it said Kit on it. You don't put nicknames on a dog tag.
Absolutely.
You know, There was a couple other things. So there's, it seems very clear that these are not actual military issued dog tags. The idea in, you know, and I just adamantly disagree with Emilio respectfully, as far as that Kit would have bought these as a novelty to give to the teenager. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the case at all. He would have tons of real dog tags. I think if he was going to give dog tags to a kid, he would give him a set of his real dog tags.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I have my uncles, you know, that's not an uncommon thing to do. But the bigger thing is, why the hell are they there? And that's the thing that threw me off. So when I try to step back from this case and look at a practical way, you know, and that's really how I look at any case when I'm kind of evaluating them, is this a potential wrongful conviction? Is there a scenario here that makes sense? You know, that's the big thing with Adnan. If you really break into Adnan's case and you look at the phone records and the timing of everything, there's not a world where he could have done it. You can't put together a logical scenario where he could have done it. And in this case, it's like, so in order for him to do it and for the evidence used to convict him to be useful, he has his dog tags. And then according to the state, he knows he's going to start a fire. So he takes the chain off his dog tags and puts a string on it instead, which is nonsense, because you're not going to, your skin's going to melt off if it's so hot. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
the plan wouldn't be that you're going to be in the fire, you know, and that your dog tags are going to be the problem.
Well, just to jump in on one split second on that, the idea that you would take the dog tag off because you're worried about the chain getting so hot, to put it on a string, to put it back on, if it was that bitch of a concern, wouldn't you just leave
just
it
take
at
it
home?
Off.
Yeah.
Right.
Just leave it at home.
Yeah. So in this theory, in order for the theory to be that he did it, right? So he has his dog tags on a string because they might get hot. And whether it's because he thinks there's going to be a fire at the murder scene, which I think is what the prosecution suggested, or just because he had him on a string because he was a pilot, whatever the reason is, he's got his dog tags on. He goes over there to commit this murder. Now, in the we heard in episode 5, if you haven't got there, the prosecution theory is that he's a criminal mastermind, because there was issues with the cell phones too, where his cell phone's going this way and the victim's cell phone's going this way kind of at the same time. And, you know, and they explain that away because he's got secret, super secret knowledge from being in the military and working for a company that handles cellular devices, that he knows how to do that somehow, manipulate data, which is bullshit. But he's a criminal mastermind, but he puts his dog tags on. He goes over and he murders this guy, and then murders the wife, and for some reason decides, I'm going to take off essentially my name tag.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take it off of my head and leave it sitting here. So that, now obviously the reason wouldn't be so that they know I did it, but any logical, clear thinking, and not even the sharpest knife in the drawer, would realize if I leave my name tag sitting here, they're going to know I did it. But he's so dumb that he takes his dog tag off and lays it there at the murder scene, takes it off his head. And you have to think about, like, even if there was some, like, for what reason in the midst of committing a murder and disposing of a body, do you stop and take off something with your fucking name on it? Take it off for any reason. And if you did, instead of putting it in your pocket, you just lay it down at the crime scene.
And the idea that it was getting in the way, like, what?
No,
what the hell?
It's under your shirt.
Yeah, it's under your, or if it's not, tuck it in your shirt. Like, what? That's, there's so many little
things. The idea that a 20-year veteran of the military is going to be concerned about his dog tag getting in the way is nonsense.
Correct.
I mean, you have them on all the time. They're always on. You shower with them on. You wear your uniform with them on. You fly planes with them on. You type at a computer with them on, they're always on. That it'd be like, oh, this thing's really driving me nuts. I got to shed some weight here. Like, what?
Yeah.
So it was the dog tags being there to me is counter evidence. It's like, it would be easier for me to believe that Kit Martin committed these murders if the dog tags weren't there.
Yeah.
But because they are there, that to me is a real good indicator that someone placed them there in order to make it look like he was there. And then you add to the fact that, you know, they're not real dog tags on top of that.
Right.
You know, and then you add to it the shell casing that's found, you know, 6 months later just happened. Oh, by the way, here's a shell casing that came from his gun.
Right.
But it that doesn't match the actual bullet used in the crime.
There's so much that doesn't make sense. And the idea that there was, this kind of goes twofold, but the idea that there was a juror that was seemingly trying to talk everybody into this. You know, I mean, there was a juror that was explaining why this could happen with the dog tags. You know, I think he was a Vietnam combat pilot, you know what I mean? But he was trying to play all these mental games, or like, as you say, the mental gymnastics of like, well, he could have put on a string because they tie it to their boot. You know, and I believe that's the same individual that continued to try to justify everything that was like every issue in the case. That juror in the jurors' room seemed to be trying to convince people that it could happen.
Well, so I was the interesting part of that. Don't we have a question about that?
We do. Which is, this is kind of twofold, because the question's not exactly about that, but it is about that juror. So the question, okay, again from Jessica. When Emilio is interviewing the juror, he mentions the state's theory that the phone was in Jones' yard for almost a month. And the juror says that he doesn't think that was the case and theorizes that Kit could have held onto the phone and taken it to Jones later. Is that allowed for a juror to not believe part of the state's theory and insert their own to still vote guilty?
So a couple things. I mean, the juror is the finder of fact, so they can believe whatever they want to believe. But also, and maybe I'm wrong here, but my understanding was that him saying that was as part of an interview with Emilio. That was, I think people were confused thinking that those are things he was saying, you know, like in the deliberation room. So I didn't take it as that's what he was saying in the deliberation room. My take on that juror was, he's trying to justify his own verdict after the fact.
Okay.
You know, it seemed like he's just trying to explain stuff away, which is frustrating.
And he had that one really, really, to me, really alarming statement in the interview. Again, I don't know if it was in the juror room or what it was, but in his interview with Emilio, he had that statement that was super alarming, which was when they were talking about the footage, the security footage, and that the prosecution was only showing parts of the security footage and was purposely leaving out parts of the security footage to make it look like there was gaps in the timeline. He justified that and said, oh, the government always does that. Why wouldn't they do that?
Yeah. And that was my read on that guy. And, you know, I only had the bits of the interviews we heard. I'm sure there was more to the conversation, but that was my read on him, was he voted to convict.
Mm-hmm.
He was confident when he did it, and now he's kind of the opposite of what I was just talking about with Jim, right? So like, now he's getting presented with new information that he didn't know, and instead of taking in the new information and considering whether his decision was accurate, he's trying to explain away everything. You know, that's what I took. He's just trying to justify. He just sent a man to prison for the rest of his life, a fellow veteran to prison for the rest of his life. And I think he's just trying to justify that. Because, like, the phone. And so the question was, and somebody in the chat here also said, too, that in the interview, he said that he didn't believe part of the state's theory. And the question is, well, are they allowed to convict if they don't believe the state's theory? I mean, yeah. So remember, the state's theory comes out in their closing arguments. That's when the state's able to present their theory. And closing arguments are not considered evidence. The jurors are instructed that's not evidence. So the jury's job is to take the actual evidence that was presented during the case in chief and be the finders of fact and determine whether that was enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the person's guilty. So they don't have to agree with the state's theory. In fact, they're really not even supposed to consider the state's theory of the case. You know, anytime you read a trial transcript, when you get to the closing arguments, the judge will repeatedly state closing arguments are not considered evidence. This is not to be weighed as evidence. This, you know, they're and that you'll see that a lot if somebody objects, right? So the defense objects to something the prosecution says in closing arguments. The judge's response is usually the same: overrule the jury's advice that this is not evidence. And so basically they can say whatever they want to. So yeah, that's a long answer, but the short answer is no, it's not a problem that the juror disagreed with part of the state's theory. Not a problem legally speaking. As far as I know, for a juror to make their own inferences on certain elements of evidence and things like that. They're allowed to do that. But now if the, well, part of the question was too, or part of the conversation, at least on that Facebook post, was, well, if he's in the jury room and he's putting his own personal knowledge in there, I think that kind of toes a line, but I think he's okay because, you know, that's why you have a jury of your peers, because that's what they're all doing, right? They're taking the evidence and they're using their own personal knowledge to determine if that evidence causes somebody. And I don't like it, but but if somebody's like, well, I don't have a problem with the dog tag being on a string because I know that helicopter pilots will put dog tags on strings sometime. I don't think legally there's a problem there with someone doing that. You're not required to wipe your memory clean. Now, if you are where you cross the line is if you read something in a newspaper that said he confessed and then that evidence was not allowed to be at trial and you're like, well, I'm voting guilty because I know that he confessed even though we didn't hear it, that you're not allowed to do. But you are allowed to weigh the evidence against your own personal knowledge and experience. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Dinner time hit, but your motivation didn't. It's time to try something different than the same three dinners you make every week. Go big or go home at 7-Eleven with their boneless wings tossed in hot honey sauce with a spot-on sweet and spicy combo. It's available at 7-Eleven and just $5 with 7 rewards. Visit your local Columbus 7-Eleven and satisfy that craving today. Valid through 6/23/26. While supplies last, participating stores, see app for full terms.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day Sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
The phone thing is very baffling to me. The fact that they did not really investigate it. I mean, they really did not. And the idea that the state's theory was that it was laying in the yard for a month and it was still an operating phone in November. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like the weather, I don't know the weather patterns of that year, but just November, it could have rained. It could be dew. The temperature alone dropping destroys a battery. I mean, there's so many factors, like the weather damage on that phone to be outside for a month and then just magically like take it in and pretend like, oh, it's fine. Look, is weird to me. And the fact that they just never tried to follow up on it, besides they drove by her house.
Yeah. Well, and the weird thing is too, it's hard to imagine her. Like, why did she take it there? I mean, it's easy to think like, oh, I want to know what's on this phone. But like, if she was truly responsible for the murders, I'm not saying she was, but if she was, like, why would you, you know, I also agree. I don't believe it was in the yard the whole time.
Yeah.
Which, you know, her saying she found it in the yard is the way of saying that I didn't have the victim's phone. But that's the most hard thing. And that's where, you know, you can't take big leaps and make huge inferences. You can only look at the facts. So the facts that I know, based on what we heard, is she had the victim's phone in her possession. That's what we know. How she got it. Now, she says she got it in the yard. Some people think that, you know, the juror thinks that Kit drove by and threw it in the yard. There, like, we can't really weigh anything because we don't know. All we know is she had the victim's phone in her possession. Now, why she then decided to take, because whether it's she knows it's the victim's phone, or let's just say it's completely innocuous. Say somebody did chuck it in her yard. Why the hell do you still, who does, like, I don't know. I can't I just have a hard time wrapping my brain around that whole scenario. It was interesting. We didn't talk about it on the podcast, and I hadn't heard it yet till I listened to episode 5. I didn't realize that Pam, I believe was the other victim's name, one of the other victims' names, that she was going to be a witness for Kit for his case, for they wrote a motion to dismiss the case, to dismiss the court martial. So when you're talking about motives, you know, who had motive and who didn't, you know, we already know, you know, that the state pushed that, you know, that because Calvin was going to testify against Kit, that was his motive. But then we also found out Calvin was also subpoenaed to testify for the defense. So it kind of goes either way there. But then you have on the same, if you're using that same logic, Pam was scheduled to testify on behalf of Kit in order to try to dismiss the case. So, you know, where does that motive fall? It would fall much on the other way, right? Towards Joan.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting case. It's easy to look at it and pick parts of it and say, there's a lot of evidence pointing towards Kit Martin. But then it's just as easy to step back and be like, there's some pretty clear evidence that he was framed. And there's also, you know, again, the phone being found at her house, the movements of the phone afterwards compared to the movements of his phone. And then there's the whole car thing. Like he could, the idea that there had to be somebody else involved, do you think? And that's another place I want to be clear where he made an inference that kind of stated his fact that another car pulled up and used their lights to shine on the car with it. Like, we don't know that. We don't know that at all. You know, that's an assumption.
That is wild. And that was one thing too, that the whole idea that there could be an accomplice, and the state even like says, yeah, there probably was an accomplice, but then they don't do anything. I mean, it's very Jennifer Jeffley. It's very, you know, I mean, it just continues to spiral. It's wild that they can do that, that they can go, yeah, I mean, it is illogical that he did this by himself, but we got him. So that's all that matters.
That's when you wish, it's like a double-edged sword, because that's when you wish the prosecution that closing arguments were evidence. Because you want to, as a juror, be like, make this make sense to me.
Right.
You have one person on trial for murder. The body's found, what did they say, 6 miles away.
Something like that, yeah.
Where the car's burned. How did he get home? Like, is there somebody, why isn't there another person? Who's, in your theory, where's this other person? Like someone else had to help them, you know, to do it. It just, but at the same time, you also don't want the prosecutions, because, you know, we've heard it in so many cases where they just spin a bunch of nonsense. And
well, even the second vehicle doesn't. So let's just presume that Kit takes the first vehicle with the bodies out to the field, runs off the road on accident, decides this is the place, lights it on fire, and walks back like the state is theorizing. Let's say that happens. Why would you move the second car?
Right.
At all.
Right. Yeah. Why move it?
Yeah.
Why go? Because, yeah, that I forgot about. I'm catching myself back up. But yeah, so then it was walked all the way back, got the second car from the driveway.
Yes.
And by the way, now you're across the street from your house where you could slide in and go to bed. And now let me get in this other car and then drive that down the road,
mm-hmm.
park that somewhere, and then walk back again. And for what purpose? And that's what I mean. It's hard to come up with a logical theory here. It's not any easier to come up with a logical theory for the alternate suspect either.
Well, you know,
it's a bizarre crime.
The thing that we know is that both cars were moved, regardless of who did it. Both cars were moved. So why the fuck right. were both cars moved?
That's what I mean. Yeah, I can't. I also, it's not like I'm like, but obviously what makes sense is Joan did it with so-and-so. It's like, right. no, that doesn't make sense either. I mean, yeah. the only thing that makes sense is there were two, and it fits a lot of things. So to me, from what I know about the case, it seems apparent to me you have two different weapons used.
Mm-hmm.
You have two different cars moved. You don't have to be a genius to draw the inference there that there was probably two people involved. You have bodies being moved, you know, moved, carried. You know, people think that, oh, if it's a grown man, they could easily move. Like, moving a dead body is not easy. Dead weight is hard to move. Or an unconscious body. It's very difficult. We used to have to train people for months and months to be able to even pass the physical agility test at the fire department, where we had to move just a 125-pound dummy. You know, it's not easy. It's very difficult. So to me, like, the scene screams, I mean, almost obviously there's two people here. Right. It had to be. It almost, I don't want to say had to, because I don't want to be doing the same thing was saying he was doing and stating things as fact. But it seems almost obvious to me there had to be two people that did this. And right. and that could also explain why you got the victim's phone going. You know, I don't know. There had to be two, whether it's Kit and somebody else, or Joan and somebody else, or two completely different people that aren't related to either one of them. But it seems like there has to be two. And then I fall back into, I don't believe Kit is stupid enough to leave his dog tags there.
Right.
And the bullet thing is, you know, that's not a stupid thing. It's, you know, bullets get ejected from guns and you can't find them all the time. That it was found so many months later when investigators missed it. But then the big thing with that bullet is, again, what screams framing is, I got a bullet that a shell casing that definitely came out of Kit Martin's gun, smoking yeah. gun. But the bullet that was used to shoot the victims did not come out of that shell casing.
Right. Baffling. Absolutely baffling.
It's not even baffling. To me, it's like someone's framing him.
Yeah.
Now, two things can be true at the same time. He could have done it and someone could frame him.
That's also, you know, true.
Yeah, I mean there's a world, and I'm not saying it's the case in this case, but there's a world where he did it, got away with it. Someone involved is frustrated that they're not catching him, and they decide to grease the wheels a little bit.
Right.
You know, let me put something here to make sure you get the right guy, air quotes.
Right. You know, and the thing that I've learned over what season are we? We're at 18. I've been on since season 7. So the last 11 seasons that I've been on this, I've learned so much, right? And the state pushing their narrative is, you know, I'm learning more and more about that. So watching the state push their narrative in this, very disheartening. You know, the idea that they're showing the jurors all these guns that Kit had, right? You're like, it's Kentucky. Everybody's got a gun. Yeah. It's like coming to Michigan right. and being like, oh, they have a gun. Yeah, everybody in Michigan's got a gun. Like, that's just what it is. Like,
if either one of you or I ever get, you were so that I, as a hunter, have a lot of guns.
Yeah,
for different types of hunting. But yeah, you could easily make a case against me and be like, look at him, he's a gun. He's got all these guns. When it's, you know, each one has a purpose. You were a professional shooter. So you've got all kinds of different guns for different reasons.
Right.
Yeah. It's just where we, you know, it's where we live. I mean, not everybody, but I mean, it's not an uncommon thing.
Right.
In some of these rural areas for people to have multiple firearms. I did find the bit in episode 5, and we need to wrap this up here pretty quick, but where they found in the house he lived in later, where they found that AR-15 22 caliber.
Yeah.
Like under the steps. That was another one where it's like, I wish he would have just presented the facts and not, because he's like, well, obviously he's trying everything he can do in these letters to let her know to get these guns out of there. It's like, there's easier ways to do that. But the good point that he made was, if that was the gun used to commit the crime. You know, and he makes, again, it's to me, it's a writer that's looking at facts that and that makes sense. He spent a lot of time pointing out that the prosecution claimed that the gun used to kill the victims was found at his house. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, then this couldn't be it because they found a different gun somewhere else. It wasn't one of those three guns they found at his house. That doesn't mean shit to me because the forensics originally didn't mean shit to me, where they're like, the 22 could have been shot out of that gun, or that gun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that tells me that 22 could have been shot out of any gun. Could have been shot out of any 22. So it didn't matter. But the point he made that I thought was a good one was, if he used two guns in the commission of the crime and then went to great lengths to hide in his own house one of the weapons that he used to commit the crime, why would he only do that with one and not both?
Right.
You know, that's hard to wrap your brain around.
So we do have one last question. I think we can answer it quickly, and I think it's a good place to leave off for this week. So Last question from Jessica. When Emilio is walking through the crime scene photos, he points out all the places where blood is found and then says there was no signs of struggle. What could have been signs of struggle if not all that blood? The house was pretty messy as well. So I think what they're asking is, like, what would it look like?
I mean, I disagree with his take there.
Okay.
You know, it's hard when you're seeing the pictures kind of flashed up, you know, here and there as you're watching without like being able to like really examine the full set. But I guess it depends on what your definition of a struggle is. You know, if you're talking about a struggle in a gunfight, I mean, yeah, there wasn't a struggle in the fact that you don't have, you know, lamps busted and knocked down and shit knocked off the walls because people are, you know, going fisticuffs with each other. There was a struggle in the fact that, you know, person was shot and then continued to try to get away until, you know, they were shot again and shot again or whatever and then died. But so, yeah, I mean, there's no sign of a struggle, I guess, in the fact that it doesn't look, you know, there's nothing to indicate there was clearly a fist fight.
Yeah.
But I guess it just depends on what your definition of a struggle is.
All right. So we got that gym interview coming up, right?
Yeah. Yep. So we're going to wrap things up here. Make sure you tune in on Sunday. Like, again, I think this is it's a really good discussion on the Delphi case. And also it's kind of, to me, it was really interesting to watch both Kathy and Jim, you know, be open to new information. And we kind of end off with me trying to convince them, like, why don't you get into the trial transcripts, get into the evidence that's all available now, and really do a deep dive on Real Crime Profile is where I think this is eventually headed. So definitely make sure you check that out on Sunday. I'm super excited. So this Thursday, you guys won't hear it till next Sunday. But I got another cool interview coming for you guys, someone we've heard from before. And also, I should point this out too. For those of you that are watching this live, you'll get a heads up on this. If you're listening to this on Friday, it was yesterday, but it's still available. I've been doing these Throwback Thursday episodes. Since I have Jim coming on Sunday, I went way back in the Truth and Justice time machine. And our Throwback Thursday episode is a remastered version of the very first time I ever interviewed Jim Clemente in 2015, 11 years ago, when I had him on for the first time when he was creating the first profile of Haman Lee's murder. So super, I found myself as I was going through cleaning up and editing it a little bit, just like getting sucked into the conversation, listening to it, because it was so crazy to hear. Also, it was like I was recording in the dog shit shed at the time on a cell phone. So Jim's voice isn't as crystal clear as you might expect, but it's better with the repurpose or the remastering I did of the audio. But yeah, super cool to hear Jim from way back then. And also, like, you know, I had talked to him a couple times. We didn't know each other that well. So it's kind of contrasting that episode Thursday with Sunday after 10 years of friendship. You know, the different dynamic is really cool. So make sure you check out the Throwback Thursday episode. I want to hear an old Truth and Justice episode with Jim Clemente. And make sure you tune in on Sunday, and we will talk to you guys all about it. I feel like this one is going to generate some questions from you guys next week on the Friday Follow-Up. Talk to you guys then.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. Co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw.
Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
What if you could get more from what you already do? When you're a Shell Fuel Rewards member, you can. When you join, you'll save 10 cents per gallon on your first fill, 20 cents per gallon on your second, 30 cents per gallon on your third, and more savings on every fill after that. Join the Shell Fuel Rewards program in the Shell app and enjoy life with more. Your nearest Shell station is closer than you think.
Lots of places can accidentally expose you to identity theft. Doctor's offices, online retailers, insurance companies, the list goes on. Thankfully, LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. LifeLock keeps an eye on your personal information, credit applications, finances, and more. And if they find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, they alert you right away. All through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Even better, alerts are automatically activated the moment you become a LifeLock member. No extra work on your part. Get the alerts that could make all the difference. Don't wait. Join LifeLock now. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.